Broadcasting from the campus of Salisbury University, this is WSDL Ocean City 90.7 FM, Delmarva Public Radio. It's time now for a special writer's edition of Delmarva Today with host Harold Wilson.
All stories are war stories somehow. Every one of us has stepped from one war to another. Our grandfathers were there when the stench of Dresden hung over the world. And our fathers were there when Vietnam sent its children running napalmed down the dirt road. Our grandmothers were there when Belfast fell into rubble. And our mothers were there when Cambodia became a crucible of bones. Our sisters in South Africa, our brothers in Gaza, and God forbid our sons and daughters will have stories to tell too. We are scripted for war. It is the job of literature to confront terrible truths of what war has done and continues to do to us. It is also the job of literature to make sense of whatever small beauty we can rescue from the maelstrom. Colum McCann, in his foreword to the book Fire and Forget. Welcome to Delmarva Today, Writer's Edition. I'm your host, Harold Wilson. We're honored to have psychologist Dr. Mary Brinkmeyer in our studio today to talk to us about the psychology of writing and storytelling in general as therapy for those suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder and other forms of stress. Dr. Brinkmeyer is a development behavioral health psychologist with the Center for Deployment Psychology at the Uniformed Services University of the Health Sciences in Bethesda, Maryland. At Portsmouth Naval Medical Center, Mary trains and supervises pre-doctoral interns and postdoctoral fellows in providing evidence-based treatment to active duty service members with an emphasis on addressing post-deployment issues. Mary obtained her undergraduate degree in psychology from the University of Chicago. She completed her pre-doctoral internship and graduate training at the University of Florida, Department of Clinical and Health Psychology, where she also completed a postdoctoral fellowship in chronic pain assessment and treatment. Prior to joining the Center for Development Psychology, Mary worked for 3 years as a health psychologist at the Naval Medical Center, Portsmouth Department of Orthopedics. She provided assessment and cognitive behavioral treatment of patients with chronic pain and related comorbid diagnosis. She also delivered training on psychological interventions for chronic pain to physical therapists, psychiatry residents, and psychology faculty, interns, and postdoctoral fellows. She was twice awarded the Florence Schaefer Memorial Award for Excellence in Psychotherapeutic Counseling. Welcome to the writer's edition of Delmarva Today, Mary.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Mary, tell us a bit about your work, what you do for the Center for Development Psychology.
Sure. Well, the Center for Deployment Psychology is in, as you said, it's in Bethesda, Maryland, and it's a center that was founded during the recent conflicts to help to train mental health professionals to address the issues of people coming back from deployments, not only the service members, but also their families. And So as part of that, they have 11 what they call deployment behavioral health psychologists who are stationed at each of the major military teaching hospitals that has a psychology training program. And so as one of those, that's how I'm at Portsmouth Naval Medical Center. So I spend about 70% of my time seeing clients and training our interns and fellows in treating our service members and their family members for a wide variety of issues. Some of them related to deployment might be post-traumatic stress disorder, chronic insomnia, depression, chronic pain. And then I spend another 30% of my time helping to develop and provide national trainings for the Center for Deployment Psychology. So we train military psychologists and social workers and psychiatrists in addressing deployment-related issues. And then we also train civilian providers who may work with our veterans or former or retired military personnel.
So in addition to training, you also, from a layman's point of view, I'll say you also do counseling and you also have your own client caseload, for example, that you deal with.
Yes, I do. I have a small caseload that I deal with in addition to the training and supervising.
And the clinical work that you do, I think you said, is not just traumatic stress disorders, but other forms of counseling as well.
Exactly. I mean, I'm trained as a chronic pain psychologist, so I do work with people who have chronic pain, which in many cases, people who come back from these deployments are suffering from chronic pain disorders. In fact, about 50% of new veterans from the Operation Iraqi Freedom or Operation Enduring Freedom, the conflicts in Iraq and Afghanistan, have chronic pain. So some of what I do is work with people who have chronic pain. And I also see clients with post-traumatic stress disorder, depression, or, you know, less significant but still distressing things like just adjustment to general life issues. So not everyone I see has deployed. I have a pretty varied caseload.
Chronic pain. Does chronic pain in this context mean dealing with pain from wounds, physical pain, or are there other kinds of pain that could be classified as chronic pain?
So, when I say chronic pain, I mean physical pain. No. But in many cases, you know, people who have chronic pain, who also have been in, let's say, military combat, have pain conditions that aren't necessarily easy for doctors to identify or treat. So these might be people who have serious physical pain, but it hasn't responded to medications or to surgery or to the usual types of interventions that should have helped it, and has a large amount of psychological factors that may be playing into it, like post-traumatic stress disorder, for instance. We know post-traumatic stress disorder and chronic pain are very often occur together, and aspects of them kind of one makes the other worse or feeds the other.
Yeah, I think let's talk a little bit about that later on,
sure,
because that's a crucial part, I think, of what we want to cover. But just kind of introductory section, I'm interested in the psychological aspects of chronic pain. I had not thought, quite frankly, about the psychological aspects of chronic pain. Can you say just a little bit more about that?
Sure. Well, someone who has chronic pain, you know, often will develop depression along with the pain, because the pain has robbed them of so many things in their life that they were able to do and has changed their role in different parts of their lives. So let's say a military service member who develops a chronic pain condition, that person is pulled away often from their command, from their friends, from their sense of responsibility and purpose, and is put into a setting where all they're doing is really getting treatment and trying to recover. But meanwhile, they're not the soldier or Marine or sailor that they had been. So they've lost that sense of themselves. Also, things at home can change, like your relationship with your partner, your spouse can really be affected by the pain. Also, people who have chronic pain tend to have insomnia more often than not, which then makes the pain worse. So it's not uncommon for people who have pain to develop depression or to have a worsening of something like an anxiety condition that went in that they had prior to the injury. So then interventions for pain are things like teaching people how to calm their body and mind down when their pain is high. So to stop the sort of pain stress cycle where your pain, if you're having, if you have a pain that flares up, then you get more stressed out. Because you're more stressed, your muscles constrict, your pain gets worse, and that stresses you out more. So teaching people how to break that cycle, how to get better sleep, how to start pacing themselves effectively, and then just work on some of the ways that they think about their pain and that they think about their lives and how they've been changed by the pain.
I find this fascinating, Mary, simply because we hear about post-traumatic stress disorder. We hear about the wounds, but we don't hear about much about the psychological aspect of the wounds and the physical pain that that comes with that. And this seems to me just a huge field all in itself.
Absolutely. It's something that so many of our service members are coming back from these conflicts with, and these are young people who have severe pain conditions. So imagine being 27 years old and having a severe chronic pain condition and how that would affect your sense of yourself and your whole future. So it's something that we don't hear as much about as we do about traumatic brain injury and about post-traumatic stress disorder,
right.
But it's actually the most common reason that service members are medically boarded out of the military is for chronic pain conditions. And the largest proportion of compensation of disability payments go to chronic pain conditions. So it's a huge problem for our troops.
Yeah, it's fascinating. Let me continue just for a moment there. How is your success rate, or what, or how are you measuring whether you're getting somewhere with the clinical work that you do with chronic pain?
So that's a really good question, because there's in the research on chronic pain treatment, there's been debate about what should you measure, right? Should you just look at what someone's pain level is, or should you look at how their depression changes, how their sleep changes, whether or not their disability level changes. And really, it's all of those things. So with pain treatment, with psychological interventions for pain management, sometimes you will see a change in the person's reported level of pain throughout treatment. So maybe they come in and they're at an 8 out of 10 pain every day, and you've taught them some really effective ways of managing their pain, and now they're down to a 5 out of 10. That would, I think, be a pretty unqualified success. But often what you see is that the pain level may not change, unfortunately, but the person has more of a sense of control over their pain. They have less depression. They're doing more with their life. So they've learned to pace themselves so that they can still do some of the things that they enjoyed without putting themselves in terrible pain. They've learned how to communicate better with their loved ones about their pain, so there's less conflict in the marriage. Maybe they're sleeping better, and they're looking at themselves in a more positive way. So rather than seeing themselves as broken or their future as completely bleak, they're able to look at the things they are still able to do and find more pleasure in those things and have more hope for their future.
So you're working with military personnel and with veterans. When someone is in an automobile accident, or someone has an accident, or even a disease that causes some kind of chronic pain for them, what kind of care are they getting out in the broader world here? Are there counselors who provide that kind of service and benefit for people who are not military personnel?
Oh, for people who aren't military personnel?
Yeah.
The field of pain psychology is really growing, so that now there are more and more centers that have either a freestanding chronic pain treatment center that has a psychologist attached, which is becoming more and more the norm, or going to a health psychologist at a freestanding psychological center that provides treatment in chronic pain. So there's more and more professionals who are being trained in this and more centers that are providing it. Nowadays, for instance, if you have a, if someone goes in for orthopedic surgery evaluation, more often than not, they will be asked to see a pain psychologist for an assessment beforehand, okay, just because we know how much psychological factors play a role in recovery from orthopedic surgery.
Right.
So
when I was in high school and I had my knee surgery as a result of high school football, they just sent me home and said, bend your knee as much as you can.
Yeah.
And there was, except for my mother, there was no psychologist at my side to encourage me as I bent my knee and cried out in pain. Let me ask you, in my studies, I learned about psychologists like Jung and Freud and Adler and others and all of the schools that came up as a result and the question when you read a book by someone was, well, are they an Adlerian or are they a Jungian or a Freudian? Is all that passé now, or are you and your colleagues are you adherents of any particular psychological school now? And are there new ones that I know nothing about these days?
Well, the school that I adhere most to and that the Center for Deployment Psychology is most oriented around is cognitive behavioral therapy, which comes from Aaron Beck, Albert Ellis, which is a more pragmatic form of therapy that doesn't really seek to look into the unconscious, right, as much as to provide people with very specific tools for managing certain problems. So, for example, learning relaxation techniques to manage anxiety, learning ways of understanding negative patterns of thinking that can lead people to more depression or more anxiety. So the focus is very much on the here and now and on providing people with specific techniques that they can then take from therapy and use. So more time limited. It's not people, you know, not like you're in analysis for 5 years anymore, you know, unless you can pay for that out of pocket. It's much more about let's look at treatment that provides really specific tools that patients can use and that has results that we can measure. For instance, like someone's score on a measure of a PTSD assessment.
Right.
You know, you look every week and watch that score move downward. So measurable outcomes as opposed to an outcome which is more just better understanding of one's problems. This is more looking at measurable outcomes.
Has technology played a role in moving us in that direction, or was it just kind of a normal progression with more keen awareness?
I think once people started to see the results that cognitive behavioral therapy can provide, that that it doesn't necessarily take 3 years of analysis.
Right.
You can actually have a very good result in, let's say, 12 to 26 weeks of therapy. That was one of the main forces driving that, because, of course, we're all moving toward therapy, you know, towards techniques that have measurable results and that insurance will pay for in a certain amount of time. But certainly technology, I think, has lends itself well to cognitive behavioral therapy because it is something that you can do in, let's say, a telehealth setting, like via telephone or web-based counseling.
So have we as a result moved more toward the management of psychological disorders, the personal management of your psychological being today and as opposed to the 3 year sessions before?
Yeah, I think that the goals now may often have shifted to resolving acute distress and giving people tools to manage their conditions, maybe rather than a really, really long-term, in-depth understanding of, you know, unconscious or early conflicts that may be contributing to them.
Yeah, that's fascinating to me. Well, we've mentioned PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder. What is PTSD, and in your experience, how does PTSD manifest itself?
Sure. So PTSD, there are several main components of PTSD. The first is that the person has to have experienced a traumatic event. This where people will joke about, well, I have PTSD from that horrible staff meeting, right? This is, yeah.
I can identify with that.
Yes. I mean, I will throw that around myself.
And you would too.
But, yeah. But so you have to have experienced an event where your life was threatened or you were threatened with really severe physical injury or sexual violence, or you witnessed something terrible happening to somebody else. So, you know, you have to. So that's the first sort of criteria, is that the person has to have experienced that sort of an event. But most people who experience those events don't go on to develop post-traumatic stress disorder, right? Most people who experience a horrible trauma have some symptoms short term. There are symptoms that are very normal for most people after they've seen something terrible, like having nightmares, having visions of it happening in front of them, having maybe difficulty sleeping, difficulty getting their mind off of it. But for most people, those symptoms gradually resolve. PTSD can be thought of more as a disorder of non-recovery or a failure to recover. So someone who has PTSD has had adequate time where those symptoms should have resolved, but they're still having them now. And so the symptoms you would see would be symptoms we call re-experiencing symptoms. So that would be nightmares or flashbacks or times during the day when something reminds them of the trauma and they become very, very upset or feel as if it's happening all over again. They also will try very hard to avoid anything that would remind them of the trauma. So they'll avoid talking about it, try to avoid thinking about it, avoid anything that would bring it to mind. So this would be someone who maybe will never watch the news because something about Iraq or Afghanistan might come on. You know, won't drive under bridges because that reminds them of something that happened with a bridge. Their lives can get smaller and smaller because what happens when you start avoiding something is that then you end up avoiding more and more and more things. So eventually this could be someone who rarely leaves the house, only leaves the house to go to doctor's appointments. Also, another category of symptoms is really changes in how the person views themselves and views the world. So someone who used to think the world was safe now views it as totally unsafe. Used to think that they were a good person, now thinks this was my fault. I'm a bad person. I deserve to suffer. I feel guilty. Has difficulty having a full range of emotions. So doesn't feel sad when they think they should feel sad. Also doesn't feel happy. Doesn't find interest in things they used to enjoy. And then also what we call over-arousal symptoms. So someone who's jumpy all the time, who is constantly scanning the room, not sleeping, startling easily, loss of temper, maybe some real risk-taking behaviors that they never had before can also be a part of that. So people taking really extreme risks in order to kind of make themselves feel something or feel alive.
You mentioned, and I think all of us have experienced this, that some traumatic event happens, or at least that we consider traumatic, and pretty soon it resolves itself and it goes away, and it may come back sometime as a mild dream or a nightmare or something, but basically it's gone. And in post-traumatic stress disorder, often it does not resolve. And do we have a sense of why that is, why it does not resolve itself? And another very interesting kind of thing is there a predisposition for post-traumatic stress disorder?
Sure. Well, there there's been a lot of research into that, and certainly that's a huge area that we need to look more at. One is there's been some research suggesting that there may be a genetic predisposition to develop post-traumatic stress disorder after a trauma. There's also certain risk factors that can put someone at more risk of developing it. So someone who maybe had a history of abuse or trauma before this event, who's already really sensitized to develop more symptoms after an event like this, or has a history of other traumas that haven't yet been resolved. You know, for military personnel, people who've had just repeated back-to-back deployments, who have had not just one traumatic experience, but multiple traumas over and over again, who other risk factors for military personnel would be maybe having a traumatic brain injury, which makes you more vulnerable to developing post-traumatic stress disorder.
Well, I know we had chatted earlier before our broadcast about Ron Kapp's book, Writing War, and I read in the introduction that he was 25 years in the military, and he was in Darfur, he was in Rwanda, he was in the Sudan, he's in Iraq, Afghanistan, and all of the horrors that he, you know, that just piles up. I'm assuming that's what that you're saying could be one cause, just all of these traumatic events just piling up and piling up.
Right, where you might be able to cope with one, but when you have the weight of so many of them, then it becomes harder to cope. And then also, when we think about just natural recovery from a traumatic event, some of the things that people might try to do to recover could put them more at risk for developing post-traumatic stress disorder. So someone who really tries to avoid thinking or talking about what happened, you know, that's, and doesn't allow themselves to really fully understand what happened or come to terms with it, you know, that would be more likely to develop post-traumatic stress disorder because they haven't allowed themselves a chance to really understand what happened or communicate it.
It was the old psychological thing back when I was growing up, was you put it in a box and you don't talk about it. And,
right.
And then it just, as you indicated earlier, just sits there, and it will find a way out of the box one way or another. I read about, and I think again in Ron Kapp's book, and I should mention his book is called Writing War. In Ron's book about adjustment disorders, is there a difference between adjustment disorders, and I'm assuming that's a kind of technical term, adjustment disorders, and PTSD?
Sure. Well, the difference is really in severity. So PTSD, now it can be sort of thought of as an extreme or more extreme form of adjustment disorder. So someone could, adjustment disorder really means just what it says, that they're having difficulty adjusting to a major stress. And that stress could be a traumatic event. But when I talked about the different symptoms of PTSD, in order to get that full diagnosis of PTSD, you have to have a certain number of symptoms from each category. And so someone who has some symptoms after a trauma, let's say that they're having, you know, a lot of trouble sleeping, that they're jumpy all the time, that they are maybe having more difficulty enjoying things, more irritable, but they're not having any nightmares or flashbacks or anything like that, that person would be more likely to get an adjustment disorder diagnosis.
And the treatment for that, is it different? Or?
So for post-traumatic stress disorder, what people really should be getting a treatment that's very much standardized and developed for PTSD.
And for adjustment disorders, we're going to talk about treatment a little bit in a moment. But for adjustment disorders, the treatment is different? Or
for adjustment
disorders,
they wouldn't necessarily need the full treatment that you would receive for PTSD, although certain parts of that treatment would still be helpful. So when we talked about cognitive behavioral therapy, someone who's got an adjustment disorder would benefit from learning, you know, ways to manage their emotions, ways of maybe getting better sleep, ways of challenging the negative thoughts they're having about themselves or the trauma, but they wouldn't necessarily need to see a therapist who has a specific training in how to do treatments for PTSD, although some parts of the treatments would look fairly similar.
Right, right. Well, we're going to take a short break now. And when we return, we'll talk to Mary about her review of the book, Fire and Forget, and we'll talk about therapies now related to post-traumatic stress disorder and other kind of stress disorders. I'm your host, Harold Wilson. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Hi, I'm Chris Heim, inviting you to join me in the Global Village for the best in music from around the globe. Each week, we journey around the world for the most compelling new releases, rare and classic recordings, birthday spotlights, and other features and specials, along with a surprising array of artists from almost every style imaginable who incorporate international sounds into their work. That's all in the Global Village, Saturdays at 4, here on WSDL 90.7 FM.
Welcome back to Delmarva Today, Writer's Edition. We're talking to Dr. Mary Brinkmeyer about the psychology of writing and its use in treating individuals with post-traumatic stress disorder. Mary is a psychologist with the Center for Development Psychology. Mary, we were talking about a little bit about post-traumatic stress disorder, and you got a little bit into the treatment. But let me ask you, first of all, is there a difference between military trauma and the resulting post-traumatic stress disorder and the PTSD caused by other trauma, such as an automobile accident or whatever?
Sure. So not always, but sometimes, I would say. One of the things that you will see in someone who has PTSD from a military trauma is a concept that's called moral injury that you wouldn't necessarily see in someone who's had, let's say, an automobile accident. And what moral injury is a sense that the things that you value and that you hold dear have been shaken or taken away by what you've been forced to see or by what you've been forced to do. So you wouldn't, let's say if you were had post-traumatic stress disorder from a car running into you, that doesn't shake your sense of who you are in the same way that having to participate in combat would. And especially when we think about the combats in Iraq and Afghanistan or the combat in Vietnam, those are all combats in which the fighting isn't done on battlefields, and the people that you're fighting are often going to be civilians, include maybe women or even children. Mm-hmm. And so people can find themselves involved in incidents where, in order to save their own life or save the lives of their buddies, they end up doing things that cause them a great deal of what we call moral injury. So a sense that maybe I'm a bad person, that the things that I thought about myself and about the world aren't true. And so that's an aspect of PTSD that is you're more likely to have from a combat trauma. And that's being more and more recognized, and the need to address that is being more, more recognized as well.
So the therapies, I have to tell you, Mary, this is really fascinating for someone who has not heard this kind of discussion. And I have to confess, I had not heard the term moral injury before. But as you explain it, and I think even when you just mentioned it, everything came to mind in the sense that exactly this has got to be exactly what happens, because you conceive of yourself to be this nice middle class person from America, and all the morals that we teach each other, and all of a sudden you're doing things that run counter to everything you've believed yourself to be. And the injury has got to be amazingly significant in that respect. And I'm assuming then that the treatment also follows. But you were going to read something for us?
So I'm going to read a brief passage from the amazing book by David Finkel called Thank You for Your Service, in which he follows a group of soldiers after they're returning home from conflict. And so there's a story of one soldier who's going through a specific treatment for PTSD that's called cognitive processing therapy, where you write about your trauma and look for the places in it that are holding you back from recovering. So the ways that the trauma changed how you view yourself, how you view the world. And so he, in this section, is reading one of his trauma accounts to his wife. And so this service member's name is Nick, and his wife is Sasha. And she's come to visit him at a treatment center, and he's wondering how much he can tell her about what happened. So Nick and Sasha duck into a visitation room stocked with some worn books and board games and sit at a table. They begin a game of Scrabble, and at some point Nick decides he'll tell her. If she really wants to know what the war was like, he'll tell her what the war was like. He slides the journal to her, opened not to the story about the bloody girl, but to what he wrote next, about a search for a high-value target. Baby, it's titled. I loved opening the night, it begins. She starts to read, and as she does, he looks down at the table and starts rearranging some of the Scrabble pieces. I don't remember what time of the year it was, but it had to be cold outside, he has written. As we near the house, the only light that is on is the one in the courtyard, so we need to move quick into this house for this high-value target. The mission, secure all military-aged males to be able to identify a certain high-value target. The first team kicks the gate clean open. I lead the second team straight through the courtyard to the front door. Using my momentum, I kick the stained glass door open, sending broken glass into the room and the door against the wall. As we move through the first room, glass cracking under our boots, we identify only women sleeping in there, so we clear the kitchen and bathroom and move upstairs. Just as I come around the staircase, a man is running down. I slam him against the wall, forcing my rifle into his neck. Just as he starts to scream, I push harder, crushing his windpipe and muffling the high-pitched yelp. I yell to one of the soldiers downstairs. I got one, he replies. Send him down. I grab the terrified man's arm, pulling him down off balance over my left foot, sending him tumbling down the stairs. We keep moving up. There are three rooms upstairs. One was already empty. Another had a man with his wife and child waiting at their bedroom door, and there was another door closed. I told one soldier to take them downstairs as me and my buddy prepared to breach this last door. I had my rifle drawn while my buddy kicked it open, and there, sitting on the side of the bed, was an older couple, just waiting like they have been through this before. I send the woman downstairs and just stared at the man as he stared back at me, waiting for me to do something. After a few seconds, I lost my temper, grabbed him by the throat, and walked him out toward the stairs. I don't know if he understood me when I told him you can either walk down or fly down, but after about 2 seconds, he started to move. Sasha, Nick's wife, finishes reading that and turns the page, but there's no more to the story. She doesn't say anything. She just looks at Nick as he continues to rearrange the Scrabble pieces. He keeps at it with more tiles and holders, and now Sasha can see a grid. What Nick is seeing, though, is Humvees and houses, and now he says that the house right there, he points to one of the tile holders, is where he threw the man down the stairs. He can see it clearly, and apparently he can hear it, too, because what he says to Sasha is the part of the story he has yet to write. There was a baby crying, then there was a woman screaming. That he got to the bottom of the stairs and saw the screaming woman holding the crying baby, and that the baby was wrapped in a blanket, and the blanket was covered in shards of stained glass. And it took him a moment, but then he got it, that the baby had been sleeping by the door he had kicked open using his 200 pounds of momentum, and when he ran in, he had just missed stepping on it, squashing it, crushing it, killing it. His scary movie, then. Here's the soldier kicking in the door, and cue the screaming baby, and here's the squish, and here's the blood, and now the screams, And even though he has seen it 3 times, 10 times, many more than 10 times, he has yet to get even remotely bored. As for what actually happened, he sees that movie too, the man he threw down the stairs, the old man he had by the throat, the screaming woman, the crying baby, the blanket covered in glass shards, the soldiers filing out, and then the lieutenant saying to them once they're outside, "This is the wrong effing house." "The wrong house," Nick says to Sasha now. "One of the things I want to remember is how many times we hit the wrong house." So I read that because it really does illustrate that concept of moral injury. So someone who didn't go into that war in order to terrorize old people and nearly kill a baby and, you know, and do it all and then find out that he was at the wrong house. You know, that sense of, this is what I did. What does this make me? Can my wife hear that and still accept me and want to be with me? And what does it mean to me that maybe at times I even enjoyed it or felt a rush during it? Because he says, you know, I loved owning the night. And how do I look back at that and make sense of who I am now?
How do you rebuild that personality?
So what you do in therapy and the type of therapy he was in that's called cognitive processing therapy is help someone as they tell their story look for what we call stuck points, those ways that they've now learned to think about themselves that are keeping them stuck in that trauma. And then you help them to start to challenge those points or look for things about those points that aren't necessarily true. So let's say if Nick said, "I'm a terrible person because I terrorize those people," what you would do is help him look at what's the entire context of what happened. You know, what were your orders? What had you experienced over and over again before this happened? You know, what were you feeling? You know, what was, you know, fear, the need, the order to capture a target? Why did you do the things you did? You do them because those are things that you do in wartime in order to keep everyone safe. So helping someone look at the entire context and reasons behind what they did instead of just looking at, you know, "I'm a bad person because I did this." And then looking at how do you want to live your life now? So what are your values? And, you know, if, you know, how do you move forward from that? How do you live your life as a good person?
How do you move forward from that?
Right. I mean, that's the question. I think, you know, the ideal is that you have someone understand that what they did in the context of, you know, of a war, that they did, that there were reasons behind it, that some of the things they did, you know, were to keep them and other people safe, and that it doesn't change, it doesn't, doing those things doesn't make them a bad person. Having done those things doesn't make them a bad person.
It sounds like to me, how do you rationalize an activity that is virtually impossible to rationalize, because you've not only got the orders, you're military personnel now, you do what you're told, but you've got, and this is the philosophical side of me coming out, but you've got, all of a sudden you've learned something about fate because you got the wrong house. And through no fault of your own, no choice of your own, through fate, all of a sudden, you're doing what you're supposed to be doing, but you're in the wrong place.
Yeah.
That's got to be really damaging.
You're doing everything that you've been trained to do, you know, and all the things that he's talking about, you know, moving through quickly, scaring people, using force. Those are all things that, if there was a high value target, if there was someone sitting there sitting on a, you know, pile of ammunition waiting to kill them, those are all the things that would keep you safe.
Right.
And so there's nothing inherently wrong in or in anything that he did. But yeah, but living with the fact that it was the wrong house, and yeah, that idea of what does that mean about the world if you can do everything right and still do terrible damage to innocent people?
Yeah. Yeah. So you have to deal. You deal with that as well, I would assume. The one thing about PTSD that interests me that you hit on a little bit is The difference, and I ask this as a question, do you find a significant difference in people suffering from PTSD and moral injury, as you call it, who are remembering what they did and what happened, and those who are actually reliving what they did and what happened? I mean, the memory becomes a real kind of thing that's going on again.
I think most people who have PTSD have some elements of both. So, you know, the memory is not only something that might come into their head and that they would think about the way that you or I would think about any memory, but to have PTSD, you have to also have what we call those re-experiencing symptoms. So that's part of the disorder, is that you're going to have times when it feels like it's happening all over again, whether that's a nightmare or whether that's seeing it play in front of your eyes like a movie.
Oh, yeah. What are the major treatments for PTSD?
So there's two treatments that the VA and the Department of Defense really recommend and have a lot of evidence behind them for treatment for PTSD. One is the one that I already mentioned, which is called cognitive processing therapy, which looks at the thoughts and beliefs that are keeping people stuck in that trauma. And so for cognitive processing therapy, there's a lot of writing that's involved in it. So the person will come in and they'll write what's called an impact statement, which is where they tell why they, not all the details of the trauma, but why they think the trauma happened and how the trauma has affected their view of themselves and the world in the future.
Yeah.
And you go through that looking for what we call stuck points. So beliefs like, I am a bad person because I raided that house, or my buddy died because I didn't save him. And then you work with the person throughout therapy to help them really attack and challenge those beliefs. You also do writing of what's called a trauma account, which is what you heard Nick in the story read, right, which is the very detailed description of what happened. Because often when people have a trauma, they're only thinking about the worst possible part of it, and they aren't really writing down or understanding the entire event. It's sort of like a book that's opens up to the worst possible page every time and then slams shut. So writing the actual trauma account can help them to more fully understand and make sense of what happened. So then you spend therapy working on those stuck points, helping them learn to challenge the way that they're thinking and see things in a different light. And then they, at the end of it, write another impact statement, which you then compare to the first one. And what you often see is a huge amount of growth. So beliefs like, my buddy died because I didn't save him, could turn into, I did everything I could for my buddy and he still died. You know, my buddy would want me to go on and live my life and be happy.
Would that be an example of a stuck point? For instance, you mentioned stuck points.
Yeah, so my stuck points are the thoughts that we have about the trauma that are keeping us there. So my buddy died because I didn't save him would be a stuck point. They're sort of irrational ways of looking at the trauma that either are telling us terrible things about ourselves or terrible things about the world. So another one might be that, you know, the world is completely unpredictable and unsafe. So since this happened to me, I have learned that the world is completely unsafe. That would be a stuck point because it's not a rational way of looking at the world. It's a way that's caused by the trauma. And so you would help the person to really look at that statement and come up with different ways of looking at the world.
Yeah. Let me ask you, you wrote a review of the book, Fire and Forget. Fire and Forget, a group of stories by veterans, pulled together by Colum McCann. What led you in your work to write a review of this book? And did you discover anything for yourself as a result of reading the book and writing the review?
Well, I wrote the review as part of my job for the Center for Deployment Psychology. You know, we're, as psychologists, we're encouraged to always be reading not only popular literature about deployment-related issues, but also the research-based literature, and then to share that with other people. And I picked the book because one thing that really struck me about it was not everyone in it was a professional writer. These were veterans who were part of the NYU Writers Project, and they were such a diverse group of writers. So the, you know, we think about war stories as, you know, maybe having very familiar themes or being told by the same sorts of people. You know, these are stories by people who range from officers, people who were officers during the war, people who were enlisted, people who were in the Army, Marines, Special Forces, spouses, and actually one spouse of someone who was deployed. So I felt like the range of perspectives that it gave you, that it was written by people who had had so many different roles in the war and whose experiences in the wars were so different, was really valuable, rather than having been written just by one particular writer right. about his or her own experiences.
Right. One of the stories in there, particularly written by a woman, I believe it was, is the sense of guilt that she felt. You've mentioned stuck points and so forth. What role does guilt play in PTSD? Does it play a large role that you found?
Well, you know, PTSD can, even though the symptoms are often the same, can look very different in different people. But for many people, guilt does play, not for everyone, but for many people, guilt does play a large role. So there's sort of irrational guilt, the idea that something bad happened to me because I'm a bad person, or yeah. something bad happened because I must be punished in some way. And so if you think about, you know, the beliefs that we have as kids growing up, there's a belief called like the just world belief, that good things happen to good people right. and bad things happen to bad people, right? And right. so when we're kids, that makes a lot of...
You should have grown up in the 1950s,
yeah,
I'll
you heard
tell
that
you.
A
that,
bit.
Was a,
yeah.
that was a big deal in the 50s.
Yeah, and even for, you know, I'm thinking about as a parent myself, like I want my daughter to think that if she, God forbid, were to go to a store and steal from it, that someone would catch her and she would be punished, right? Mm-hmm. You don't want to teach your kids that, you know, if you do bad things, then maybe you'll get caught and maybe not. And if you do good things, maybe bad things will still happen to you. You know, we want right. our, we want to believe that if you do good, good will happen. And if you do bad, bad will happen. So, you know, but then you get put in a situation like a combat situation where bad things happen, horrible things happen. Then you, people in a sense, in trying to make sense of that, often think, well, it must be because I did something wrong, or it must be because I'm a bad person right. or I'm being punished in some way. Right. And that sense also just of the immense love and bonds between service members also can lead to immense amounts of guilt when your buddy, for instance, dies and you tried your best to save them, but you didn't. Or maybe right. you were supposed to go on a mission and your buddy volunteered to go instead because he knew you really wanted to be able to Skype with your family, and then he gets killed. You know, the interpretation that that was my fault, it should have been me.
Right. That's well, you mentioned writing earlier. Let me ask, how else do you use writing, and what happens to us when we write? What happens in the process of writing that you've discovered?
I mean, one thing that happens when we write is that it really forces us to slow down and try to understand what happened, rather than the sort of quick interpretations that we often make. And again, with trauma, so much of what people do is to try to avoid thinking about it, so they don't really give themselves the chance to fully understand it. So writing forces you to really consider the context and consider every part of what happened, instead of just, for example, the person who's, you know, my buddy died because I couldn't save them. If that's the only thing they're thinking when they're thinking about the trauma, then maybe they're not really thinking about all the things that they did do to try to help their buddy. They're only flashing back to that moment of their buddy's death, Whereas if they're forced to Whereas if they're forced to write about all of it, then they can get more of an understanding of the entire event and of what their role was in it.
Is there any sense, Mary, in writing of getting the event outside yourself? Does that make any sense at all? I mean, when you tell a story, stories change. The different elements come out and different emotions come out when you tell a story. And the story may be even a little different each time you tell it. When you write something down, however, you have frozen it. It doesn't change after that.
Yeah, and when you write, you have to sort of step outside of your own emotions in order to be, I mean, that process of taking it outside of your own emotions and putting it on paper and choosing words and, you know, organizing it and, you know, all of that can take some of the emotion out of it and put it in a, like you said, step outside of yourself. So stepping outside of those direct emotions and making more sense of what happened.
And what happens when a client revisits their writing? Is there something that happens to them in that exchange, reading their own writing?
Sometimes clients are really amazed at the amount. Maybe they've frozen out their emotions and haven't been able to feel them, are amazed at the amount of emotions that they have with it. Sometimes they can come to sort of, as they're reading it, realizing, oh yeah, you know, as I was reading this, I realized that this didn't really make a lot of sense. Or I realized that maybe I did do more than I expected.
And in terms of, I want to go back to the guilt again, that stuck point of guilt. How would writing the events help you deal with the guilt that you feel about this event? Is there a connection?
Well, I mean, one way would be to actually allow yourself to put all of that guilt out on paper and experience it rather than trying to push it away constantly. And then once you do that, you know, not only writing it, but also sharing that with a therapist, reading it and help and, you know, picking it apart and helping to understand it.
And coming perhaps to the sense wait a minute, maybe this was not my fault.
Right. As I write the entire event down, as I look at everything that happened in the whole picture, you know, I started to realize it was more complicated than just what I would flash back to and that horrible sense of guilt I would feel every time I would think about it.
Yeah. Can PTSD be cured, Mary, or is it just something one manages?
Well, for some people, absolutely. I mean, the research shows that with proper treatment, you know, a majority of people no longer have the full symptoms of PTSD. Now, that doesn't mean that they no longer have any effects from the trauma, but that they can actually function very normally and have the trauma be a bad memory that they can deal with, but not something that haunts them or forever. Depends on, you know, the individual, the other things that are going on. Do they have just PTSD or do they have PTSD plus a traumatic brain injury plus severe depression plus chronic pain?
Right.
You know, the more that you sort of pile on there, the less likely it is that the person's going to be entirely recovered.
Right.
But certainly one thing that has been so exciting about the discovery of these evidence-based treatments is that we see that in a relatively short period of time, people can get so much better. And, you know, the thought that PTSD was something that someone would always have their whole life is not the way we're thinking about it anymore. You know, we're realizing that just, you know, the way we used to treat PTSD was just plain old talk therapy. So you come in and you and I are going to discuss, how was your week? How are you feeling? Let's talk more about the trauma, you know, those sorts of things. That didn't tend to cure people from their PTSD. So regular talk therapy didn't work. But with treatments that have been specifically designed for it, people do get much, much better.
We're We're almost out of time, Mary. Boy, it's gone really very,
it has
very
gone
quickly.
Fast.
It's gone very quickly. But I do need to ask you one question, if you can do a short answer for it. We have books like Colin McCann's Fire and Forget and Tim O'Brien's The Things They Carry. How should we read their work? Is there a particular way we ought to approach their literature, that literature?
Gosh, that's a good question. I would say, I mean, approaching it with a very open mind and recognizing that not every service member's story is the same, not everybody's interpretation is the same, and that everyone has their own story to tell that we can learn from.
Well, Mary, clearly the work you're doing is incredibly valuable to those who serve our country under unimaginable conditions. Thank you very much for being here today and for sharing your insights with us.
Well, thank you for having me.
This is Harold Wilson. Thank you for listening to Delmarva Today, the Writer's Edition.
You've been listening to a special Writer's Edition of Delmarva Today with your host, Harold Wilson. This program is produced on the campus of Salisbury University for Delmarva Public Radio. Christopher Rank is your audio engineer. Mary Seaman is the volunteer producer. Visit our website, delmarvapublicradio.net, for podcasts of this program.